Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about a coherent federal energy policy. Our guest is Michael Vickerman, who's the executive director of Renew Wisconsin. You can find out more about what they're doing at renewwisconsin.org. And Michael, thank you so much for coming in to spend time with us today.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
You wrote your Federal Energy Policy, Can It Happen Here? That is available on the website. And as you reveal, Congress has not had a good record in turning up a coherent energy policy in the past few years. And as they debate the energy bill right now in the House, are you apprehensive about what might come out? Are you excited about the possibilities? What do you think?
I'm always apprehensive whenever Congress gets together and talks about energy, because it's clear that they don't really have a strong conceptual handle on the issues that affect or go into the fashioning of an energy policy. One of the frustrating things about observing Congress is that they don't seem to want to use the right benchmarks for gauging progress, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
If it is the goal of Congress and the executive branch to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and also increase energy security, the way to do that is to reduce reliance on the fuels that put us at risk. That would be crude oil, petroleum, diesel. These are fuels that we import much more of than we produce, and coal is another resource that is also finite and also is probably the biggest contributor of any fossil fuel to greenhouse gas emissions. So it would follow that you would want to fashion policy that aims at actual reductions in the energy use. But that goes against various industry imperatives. They want to sell more of whatever it is they're in business with. So, you know, the coal barons want to sell more coal. The refineries want to produce more gasoline and diesel. And so you have these powerful organized interests, and you have another problem, which is the fact that the energy resources are not evenly scattered in this country. Some regions have more of, for example, oil and gas than other regions. New England, to name one region, doesn't have any real energy industry that is part of its domestic economy. So you have this clash then of competing interests, economic interests, regional interests, and there's really no one at the top to sort things out and to push this conflicted mass in a particular direction.
We're talking with Michael Vickerman, the executive director of Renew Wisconsin, about the federal energy policy as spelled out in the energy bill being considered in the House at this time. And if you'd like to join the conversation, all you have to do is give us a call in Madison at 263-1890 or our toll-free number at 800-642-1234. We'd be glad to hear from you. It's not a secret that Congress is extremely reluctant to offend the powerful energy lobbies that you've mentioned, such as Big Coal. Is it possible to institute policy changes without picking a fight with the coal industry, the electric utilities, and the U.S. auto industry?
Well, I'm pessimistic, but I don't want to rule it out as just an impossibility. But it will require much more leadership on the part of the executive branch than what we see now. And we have to have some legislative champions of a unified, internally consistent policy come to the fore and make the case to the citizens that it would be better if prices of the price of gasoline were actually a little higher, and we appropriate some of that higher revenue towards building up a sustainable energy economy of tomorrow. It is not impossible for other countries to accomplish that, but given the the complexity of politics in this country, particularly in the legislative branch, that we have domestic and regional interests. It's a very difficult thing to accomplish. It really does require having a much more thoroughgoing conversation about energy than what we have right now.
We're talking with Michael Vickerman. Is gas at $3 a gallon still a good deal for consumers?
Well, it certainly is. It may be a higher price than what consumers or motorists were paying 2 years ago, but compared with what it does for people, and compared with other things you buy in liquid form, it is an astonishing bargain. This is one of the most energetic substances in on the planet. And it doesn't take much to power a 2-ton vehicle and several passengers inside 25 miles. And you know, you try to do that with any other liquid substance you can buy in a supermarket, a mouthwash or diet soda or an energy drink. It's a miraculously energetic substance, and the fact that it's available for only $3 a gallon is something that, what it's resulting in is an inability to value its contribution properly, and we now have a system of commodity pricing that does not account for the fact that one day supplies of gasoline and other motor fuels will diminish, and it'll become progressively more expensive. And furthermore, no matter how high the price might go, we'll reach a point where we can't have in the future the same volume that we have today. And unfortunately, the way gasoline is priced, there is no consideration of that that inevitability. Whether it's 2 years out, 10 years out, 20 years out, it's just not factored into the price, and that's going to come back and really bite us big time in the not-too-distant future.
The number in Madison for you to join the conversation is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. As we talk with Michael Vickerman about this energy policy, let's go to the phones and take some calls, and we're going to get Mike involved in the conversation. Mike, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, good morning. A question for your guest. Yeah, you know, energy is so all-encompassing in our lives. I mean, we go to war over it, and my concern is, it seems to me that the politicians are always coming up with energy policies, but it would seem to me that there's really no national, nonpartisan energy policy. In other words, how much oil is there? You know, where is it? Who has it? Who controls it? When is it going to run out? What are we going to do to replace it? It's like you hear every so often that somebody's coming out with a new energy policy, but it all seems so short-term. I'd just like your guest comment on that.
Well, usually Congress responds to the exigencies of the moment, and it's going to respond to the $3 a gallon gas. That's the prevailing price right now. The caller mentioned referred to the poor quality of information we have about what kind of energy resources are really out there. It is appalling to me that we know so little about the reserve situation in the Middle East. This has been a continuing frustration for people who are in the business of planning future investments in oil and gas extraction and also refining. You know, does Saudi Arabia really have 60 years of oil left underneath the ground, or is it a much smaller number? And what is the quality of the oil that's being extracted from Saudi Arabia right now? How much water is in that oil that has to be removed? The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia operates with a virtual cloak around its borders. And very few people are allowed to even obtain a glimpse of the whole energy production apparatus that's there. And if we have trouble figuring out how much extractable oil there is in the world, then it seems to me the prudent thing to do is to move to ways where we actually use less of it, because we're just not sure whether it's there or not. And unfortunately, all Congress is really able to do is to provide subsidies to various different energy interests out there, but it never quite equals a recognizable product in the end. It's not a cake. It's not a casserole. It's just kind of a mess of subsidies that are thrown into 700 pages of text.
Mike, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go on to Christopher in Madison. Christopher, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm concerned about peak oil, and I've been studying it for several years. I know that Roscoe Mitchell, a senator from Arkansas, I think, is trying to bring this to the attention of the Congress. And Matthew Simons, who's an energy expert, wrote a big fat book called Twilight in the Desert about the availability and the secrecy surrounding Saudi oil. And I think many people should read that book. It's very, very scary what is about to descend upon us. Like unspeakable horrors will fall upon our country within the next 5 to 10 years unless we start to introduce larger rail and major energy efficiency measures all across the board. I mean, people in America will be starving. The industrial age was fueled by petroleum, by cheap petroleum. And there's a theory out there that it's going to last about 100 years from 1930 to 2030, and then the gas is basically going to be gone. The cheap petroleum is going to be gone, and our civilizations all over the planet are in danger of demise, that there might be a massive die-off of people on this planet because we cannot produce and ship food. I'd be interested in hearing your comments about this.
There's a lot to respond to, but I need to correct a couple things that the caller said. First of all, the person he was referring to in Congress is named Roscoe Bartlett, and he is a congressman from Maryland. He's actually going to be in the state of Wisconsin in a couple of weeks. August 15th, he's speaking at an energy forum in Manitowoc. Roscoe Bartlett, he is the chair of the Peak Oil Caucus in the House. And the book that the caller referred to is called Twilight in the Desert by Matthew Simons, who used to be CEO of an energy investment banking house headquartered in Houston. But what the caller refers to is the concept of peak oil. Let me just define peak oil very quickly for your listeners. It is that point, usually around the halfway mark in the lifespan of a resource, where where maximum output is obtained. But beyond that point, it really doesn't matter how many mines or how many wells are sunk into the ground. So much of the easy to access resource has been removed that what remains is really the scrapings on in the bottom. It's the higher hanging fruit that's less easy to get to. And there is going to be a point in the humanity's relationship with petroleum that where what comes out of the ground will substantially decline. And it could be an extraordinarily traumatic event if we're not if we're not careful, we don't plan for it. And again, this is sort of like taking out an insurance policy, the whole idea of conservation and using less of these depletable fuels. What we are doing is cushioning the possibility of economic dislocation and trauma, because the energy contained in petroleum, it permeates through the entire economy. It's a big part of the foods industry in the United States. Medicines, petrochemicals, most of our consumer products have some petroleum in them. And it behooves us as people, as a species that can peer into the future, to recognize the dangers out there and start backing away from the cliff. But unfortunately, not only are we headed towards the cliff, we seem to be accelerating towards it.
Thank you very much for your call, Christopher, and for bringing that alarming and dire future into our thinking. We're talking about a coherent federal energy policy with Michael Vickerman. He's the executive director of Renew Wisconsin. You can find more about them at renewwisconsin.org. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about energy policy. If you'd like to join the conversation, it's easy. Pick up the phone and dial 263-1890 if you are in Madison. Anywhere else, 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, of course, is talk@wpr.org. The House of Representatives is working this week on House Resolution 969. And if it passes, I'm told it'll be like taking 37 million cars off the road. Do you see that happening, Michael?
It will depend entirely on the fate of several amendments that will be introduced on the House floor on Friday. I'm not sure where that 37 million car figure came from. I'm a little skeptical of it. My view is what is likely to emerge out of the House are a series of tax credits and a mild tightening up of automobile fuel efficiency standards. Any forward movement in that direction would be positive. There's no reason why cars have to waste so much energy. I mean, if energy is the lifeblood of this of this economy and our society, then it is frankly just too valuable to waste. But actually, what we're seeing in Congress is sort of the tail wagging the dog. The more important, more aggressive work is being pursued at the state level. Some states are just not waiting around for Congress to get its act together. An example of that, of course, is California, which adopted a very ambitious package of incentives and regulations to reduce the carbon footprint of that state's economy on the electric side, on the transportation side, and it is rather alarming, actually, to other places in the country to see one state take such bold and visionary action. And so this is stirring some interest in the House and the Senate. They're thinking that, well, we can't have 50 states go in their own direction here, 50 states with different tax policies, 50 states with different emissions policies. We're going to have to do something. But what's likely to emerge will be, in effect, the lowest common denominator.
Okay. Back to the phones we go, and let's be joined by Tom in Oshkosh. Hi, Tom.
Hello. I guess thanks for taking my call. My question has always been, since the Bush administration has been in office, there's been a secrecy over the energy policy that administration has implemented or tried to implement. And the secrecy involving Vice President Cheney has always interested me, because it's considering the Enron collapse and all the energy companies that failed, his guarded stance on protecting who was in the meeting and what was said is always been a big concern of mine. I was just wondering if you had a comment on that.
Yes, I do, and thank you for raising that point. I think the motivation, the overriding motivation for those secret meetings between the administration and various energy executives and trade association heads is the kind of information that was exchanged would be rather difficult to disclose in a public hearing because of some of the more alarming aspects of it. If there was a candid discussion on energy security, surely the topic of peak oil would have come up. But peak oil is at this point a subject that is absolutely verboten in any kind of legislative forum. It's just not. The words practically don't exist, and if you invoke them under oath or in front of a camera, you might as well have a net dropped onto you, and the authorities carry you away. So, but the administration was thinking about plans to bring more oil into the United States and into world markets, and they wanted to figure out the politically the most expedient path to reach that. It was unfortunately a serious mistake on Vice President Cheney's part to dismiss conservation and efficiency as being a strategy for enhancing energy security. He basically marginalized it, called it, it's nice as a personal virtue, but it's lacking as a policy. I think he has that 180 degrees wrong, that all policy should start with conservation and efficiency. And that just, in doing so, it takes the pressure off of oil producers, coal producers, electricity generators to add more capacity. And that's and for that reason, the secret discussions that took place at the outset of the Bush administration were so counterproductive.
What does the current Resolution 969 say about efficiency and say about energy savings?
To be honest, I'm not sure. I suspect that it will continue the or extend the tax credits that are in place, but they're rather modest. The tax credits to incentivize homeowners to add more insulation to their house or replace windows. The previous energy bill, which was passed in August 2005, contains some very good incentives for the use of solar, promoting solar installations by both residences and businesses. And we would certainly like to see those incentives extended. But the way Congress works, these tax credits have a limited life, maybe 2 years, maybe 3 years. It's very much a perils of Pauline situation in which Congress not only plays the hero when it extends the credit, mm-hmm. but also plays the villain because it lets the clock tick down to the last couple months before extending these tax credits. So it's sort of like the Dudley Do-Right and the Snidely Whiplash character all rolled into one. In contrast, you look over the Atlantic Ocean to Europe, and you will see policies that have been placed for more than 10 years, and they're not... And they're part of the institutional bedrock in those countries, policies that guarantee a certain price for renewable generation, for example. They're much more effective in places like Germany and Spain and Denmark than what we have here, which are basically set asides for either ethanol on the transportation side or wind, solar, and other renewables on the electricity side.
Back to the phones we go to John in Gordon. John, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for taking
sure.
my call. Mr. Barrick, I listened to a recent piece on Slate magazine called The Great Corn Con, in which the author was asserting that in order for corn grown to generate ethanol to meet the federal goals, we'd need to commit an area of the United States equal to the size of Kentucky, and that the possibility of doing this is just sheer fabrication. I'm wondering if you have either read that piece or would like to comment on ethanol as our savior.
I have not read that piece, but my opinions on ethanol are pretty well established. the problem with ethanol is that it is integrally linked with the corn-intensive agriculture that's practiced in the United States, and we have practically whole states that are assigned for the production of corn for meat production, and now corn for human consumption, and corn for as motor fuel. And I'm afraid, I'm very leery of the energy bill containing a biofuels mandate or an ethanol mandate that would if anything, intensify our over-reliance on corn. The energy balance on ethanol is really not very good if it's derived from a grain like corn. And so when we say it has a energy balance of 1.3 to 1, it means that we're only receiving a fraction of the original input in terms of new energy. And that fraction has to support all the other things that create or that society are composed of. When you consider the energy balance of wind power or a very large oil reservoir, they're practically not even in the same spectrum. The largest oil field in Saudi Arabia is estimated to have a net energy balance of over 100 to 1. And so it can support, for example, professional sports. It can support four-year colleges. It can support a mammoth prison system, which are essentially unproductive, or I should say non-wealth-producing sectors of the economy. But if you go to ethanol, with its barely positive energy return, there isn't a whole lot you can do with ethanol other than be in the business of making ethanol. That's what a 1.3 to 1 energy return means. So it would not be good policy, as President Bush outlined in his State of the Union address, to quintuple the volume of biofuels to serve the transportation market. It would be very, very short-sighted.
What are your thoughts about the designation of the University of Wisconsin-Madison as one of three centers for biofuel research to perhaps get away from corn as the primary fuel source of the future?
Well, any steps we take to search for alternative feedstocks to corn are good things. That if we can find a way to unlock the energy and the energy contained in wood or in grasses, that offers the possibility of it being more sustainable. But when you talk about corn-derived ethanol, you have to remember that the ethanol distilleries themselves are huge energy sinks. You need natural gas to supply the heat to as part of the distillation process. They require quite a lot of electricity as well. And in fact, in a state like Iowa, it's ethanol plants that are driving utilities there to propose more coal-fired plants. So, I mean, if people knew about the relationship between ethanol plants and proposals to build more coal capacity, perhaps that would cool their enthusiasm for ethanol. We don't look at it as a savior, but if we can find other sources of the fuel that are far less injurious to the environment, I think that's worth pursuing.
Michael Vickerman is the executive director of Renew Wisconsin. Their website is renewwisconsin.org, and we're talking about federal energy policy as being discussed today in the House. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's 800-642-1234. Let's go to Deanna next in Green Bay. Hello, Deanna. What's on your mind?
Hi. I had a question regarding our continued global reliance on foreign oil and the oil sands resource in Alberta and how that might affect our consumption, our continued consumption of oil and petroleum products.
Oh, sure. That's a very, very interesting wrinkle in North American energy picture. What the caller is referring to are these oil-soaked layers of sand in northern Alberta. It's actually not, strictly speaking, crude oil. It's called bitumen. And it requires a great deal of energy to extract the ore and to separate the ore from the sand and to upgrade it to the point where it becomes a usable feedstock for refined products like gasoline and diesel. This is Canada's looking at its oil sands as kind of its meal ticket for the future. And it happens to be located entirely in one province. The other oil deposits in Canada are actually showing signs of decline. So the industry has to shift from the other basins where oil has been extracted to Alberta. And considering its significant energy requirements. This is going to have implications not only for America's petroleum picture, but also for North American natural gas, because it takes an awful lot of pressurized steam to separate oil sand or the oil from the sand, and if natural gas in Canada is diverted to oil sands production, that means less natural gas going for other things, such as heating fuel or as generator fuel. Canada is has been a very compliant energy province of the United States so far, and about 15% of the natural gas that comes into the United States originates in Canada. So if there is a diminishing of supply, if many thousands of therms are instead diverted to producing this low-grade oil, then we can expect to see higher heating costs in the future. One Canadian executive likened it as using gold to produce lead. That's in reference to the low energy return on oil sands, but America has few options because of its non-existent conservation policy. So and not only that, you have this interesting situation where Canada is a signatory under NAFTA and really cannot withhold supplies of natural gas or any other energy commodity for its own population. It is committed to serving the entire North American marketplace, and having signed away its energy sovereignty like that, the oil sands question might result in a change of policy in Canada in the coming years, especially if natural gas output starts to decline.
Deanna, thank you very much for your call and for bringing up that point. We'll continue to take your calls in just a moment as we talk with Michael Vickerman, the Executive Director of Renew Wisconsin, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, in for Kathleen Dunn. Happy to have you along with us today as we continue to talk about a national federal energy policy with Michael Vickerman. If you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's set this up. The House is getting ready to go on its summer recess. This is perhaps the last major bill that will be voted on this week. And what's the likelihood in the Senate that the Senate would go along, or has the Senate passed a companion bill of its own?
The Senate acted last month, early last month. It debated the contents of an energy bill. The outcome was very interesting. because there was a concerted effort to underwrite the various tax subsidies by closing various tax loopholes that oil and gas industries have been enjoying in the last couple of years. So instead of borrowing money to underwrite or support the various tax incentives and credits, the Senate tried to fashion a real-time transfer of wealth so as not to saddle future Americans with greater levels of indebtedness. And this was a so the tax committee passed a $29 billion package, and it included five-year-long tax credits for wind, solar, and other renewable resources. And it failed as an amendment to be attached to the larger energy bill by a 57-36 vote. There were 57 votes in favor of this amendment and 36 votes that opposed. But this, unfortunately, the vote came in the form of a motion to stop debate. And the Senate rules require that at least 60 votes are cast in order to shut off debate. Because the Senate came up three votes short, this rather progressive tax package, which, in my view, actually did constitute enlightened energy policy, it fell short. And so the bill that cleared the Senate actually is rather it's rather narrowly focused. It does have some language to raise fuel efficiency standards, but it did not extend renewable energy tax credits. So when the House passes its version of an energy package, then the two halves of the bill go into a conference committee, and and there's a group of about 25 senators and members of Congress. They sit down and they hash things out. And so it's our hope that the House will prevail on the Senate to bring back the renewable energy tax credits that were left on the Senate floor back in July.
Let's go to the phones again, and we'll go to, is it Kohler or Kohler?
Kohler.
Kohler in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi, just got a quick question. Why is everybody afraid to talk about nuclear power, and how could it relieve some of the energy stresses that we have in America? I'll take the answer offline, because I got to get going to an interview here.
All right, caller.
That's a very good question. The caller is correct. There is a general level of squeamishness about discussions of nuclear energy, and it's time that we sort of get a grip and deal with the pluses and minuses of nuclear energy. My view is that nuclear is a rather expensive option, but if it were tied to a megawatt for megawatt retirement of existing coal plants, then you could definitively say that nuclear this policy would reduce the amount of carbon dioxide and other pollutants into the atmosphere. But the fact is that, and this is something that doesn't come out in conversations, nuclear right now is an unfinanceable option in the United States. That is to say, lending institutions and investment banks won't commit dollars to build a new nuclear plant. And the reason for that is they're not sure whether if there are cost overruns or some other change in policy, whether the investors will fully recoup their the capital that they put into this project. And that's the main reason why nuclear power has not been expanded significantly in the last 30 years. It's really the financial risks involved that have that have resulted in it becoming this kind of dormant option out there. But we should have a more thoroughgoing, vigorous discussion about nuclear, because it could possibly it could be part of a policy that leads to reduced greenhouse gas emissions, but you have to be careful about how it's integrated into a broader package.
The issue of disposal of nuclear waste is one that has been left hanging for years and years and years. Doesn't that have to be settled before you could proceed with an expansion of nuclear power?
It should be settled, and just haven't made progress on that score. I mean, nuclear energy does have serious liabilities. It also happens to it's not an option that's going to materialize, even if we took away all the barriers this year. We still wouldn't see the first nuclear power plant come online till about 2015, 2016. There are still some very pro-nuclear utilities out there, but even they acknowledge that between the financial environment and between the waste disposal, the lack of resolution about long-term waste disposal, that it's just not worth the risks now. So those risks would have to be tackled head on before we would see a resurgence of the nuclear power industry.
We're talking with Michael Vickerman, the executive director of Renew Wisconsin, and let's go to Judy in West Madison next. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'd like to bring out a point that was finally driven home to me recently, and I don't have all of the numbers, but the biggest chunk of our use of oil, it goes for the transportation sector, and to replace that, we can't replace that necessarily with solar or wind, and I'm a big advocate of solar and wind. We have to have energy efficiency in our vehicles, so I'm a proponent of plug-in hybrids, which can be plugged in overnight and use the excess capacity of our power plants without adding any new plants to power the electric part of the plug-in hybrid vehicle.
The caller raises the valuable point of the possibility of introducing electricity as a fuel for vehicles, and not just private vehicles, but also streetcars and railroads. As is the practice in other advanced industrial societies, particularly in Europe. I think it is possible to use renewable energy mixed in with baseload energy to supplant or displace the use of liquid fossil fuels for transportation purposes. The grid is in relatively decent shape compared with the liquid fuel situation, and there's plenty of opportunity to add wind farms for the purpose of supplying electricity at night that can power automobiles or charge them up at night, and they can operate during the day. I think a serious energy policy would have a component for electrifying public and private transport. I think that's really the way to go. I'm much more optimistic about the capacity of electricity to handle some of the transportation load than corn or other feedstocks. One other thing, that is the cost of electricity used to power a car 25 miles is about one-third the cost of gasoline. Electricity is truly the cheapest energy commodity out there right now. So it's either if you had an electric car and you wanted to go 25 miles, it'll cost you a dollar's worth of electricity as opposed to $3 worth of gasoline. That price disparity is certain to become larger. It's certain to widen as time goes on. So if we're truly farsighted, we would start investing some of the wealth created from fossil fuels today into electrified rail and electrified streetcars and electrified private cars.
Judy, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Frank in Oshkosh next. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I would like to hear some discussion on some of the topics like the new urbanist cover, you know, and they continue to talk about that there's no way of fueling this happy motoring society that we have with alternative energy or wind or whatever unless we begin to also look at restructuring the way we live and the way we build our cities. And I was just wondering if you could comment on that.
The caller is referring to tremendous per capita usage of energy that comes about with a spread out living arrangement, which is pretty much what we have here in the United States. It's very difficult to run one's errands on foot or even in a bicycle. If the nearest grocery store is 3 miles, if the nearest church is 7 miles, and the nearest department store is 25 miles away, a department store like Walmart or Target. These living arrangements do exacerbate the fuel consumption problem. I don't know if this is the sort of thing that can be truly dealt with in legislation apart from investing in public transportation. That would help. Public transportation in cities and between cities, connecting, for example, Milwaukee and Madison and Madison with the Twin Cities in Minnesota. That, I think, would have to be a priority. And some of the new urbanists that the caller referenced have been ardent proponents and champions of expanding our rail infrastructure, which, unfortunately, over the last 50 years and the happy motoring utopia that the caller referenced, it's been allowed to go to seed, and it's going to take many billions of dollars to refurbish the country's rail system into something that can be an efficient mover of goods and people.
Frank, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. And Ruth, let's give you a chance today. Hi, Ruth.
Hello. Though I said I'm from Hiles, I'm vacationing here from Indiana, where ethanol plants are sprouting like weeds, mm-hmm. only because they're being subsidized so highly by the government. And anybody who studied the ethanol question knows all the bad parts about corn ethanol. What can we do to stop our politicians from supporting this plan with all the government subsidies, et cetera?
That's a very good question, and unfortunately, I'm not really aware of any environmental group or other advocacy work that has drawn a bead on the proliferation of ethanol plants. I think actually the ethanol industry, while it's growing now and it's expanding at a more than healthy clip, there are some serious constraints to its long-term growth prospects. Access to water, which is a serious constraint in the West, access to cheap power, and most importantly, having enough corn grown nearby to support the flow of feedstock through the process. I came across a term not too long ago called corn shed. What we're talking about with corn sheds is the claim that an individual ethanol plant has on the farms around them, and there is there's evidence suggesting that particularly in Iowa, the amount of ethanol distillation operations under construction now may exceed the amount of corn that can be turned or converted into ethanol.
We've all seen the prices of our food, especially milk, go up, which they tell me is because of corn prices going up. So it's going to affect much more than the energy sector. Well, thank you for answering that question.
Ruth, thank you very much for your call. Let's get one more call in before we probably have to go, and that's Carl in Lake Delton. Hi, Carl.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this program and a very insightful guest. Thank you for giving us your time this morning, sir. Just two comments. One, there's a circumstances, and they call it the law of unintended consequences, and that's what you kind of see in this. And I'm old enough to remember when the interstate highways were built and the railroads were put out of business or pretty much, you know, eliminated passenger transportation. And now we're paying the price of having personal cars and no mass transit, at least in Wisconsin. Also, there's an interesting article in the current edition of Photonic Spectra magazine, the July 07 magazine, and it's called Solar Technology, Seeking a Stay in the Sun. And there's an interesting chart on page 44 of the magazine.
Give me that magazine name again.
Photonics Spectra.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there, Carl, because we have run out of time. And I thank you for raising those points. And if people want more information, they can seek that out. Michael, thank you so much for coming in and spending an hour with us today.
A pleasure, Jim.
We will look forward to a return visit. The topic today, a coherent federal energy policy. Our guest, Michael Vickerman, Executive Director of Renew Wisconsin. You can find out what they're about at www.renewwisconsin.org. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.